Welcome to the Food Junkies Recovery Story Podcast. Here we aim to provide you with the experience, strength, and hope of everyday people actively working on their recovery from food addiction. I hope to inspire you and increase your awareness about recovery from food addiction. Here we will talk about personal stories of recovery and the many ways to live in recovery. We will focus on the various solutions so that you can choose the best option for yourself. I want to encourage you to thrive rather than just survive. So stay positive, make changes for yourself, tell others about your changes, and our message of hope will spread. Well, Food Junkies podcast listeners, I have a big treat for you today. My friend Linda Witnoff is joining me today. And Linda has been on this journey for quite some time, and I'm super excited about talking to her about it because she can share all the different things of long-term about her journey. And we will talk about some really interesting things because initially when I started talking to her, we have talked about a few word choices that are different, and I can't wait to hear her perspective on it. So Linda, I'm going to welcome you to the podcast and go ahead and get started with the first question that you can just, however you want to talk about your journey. How did you get started with this journey?
Well, hi, CJ. It's really great. I'm so excited to be here. So I come from a household of overeaters, I would say. And my mom was about, I don't know what, you know, considered probably 100 pounds overweight. And she struggled with it my whole life. She'd go up and down a little bit. She called it her cross to bear. So there was shame. And she really didn't, you know, like her body. And I picked that up so early. At the beginning, though, like I have a really clear memory, and I treasure this because I think it's maybe part of my recovery, that I was really in touch with my body. Like I remember dancing around the living room, you know, and being like very coordinated and graceful, actually, I think, until I was about 6 years old. And something happened. There was like a family trauma that involved grandparents, and I won't go into all that stuff. But that's when I started to be very unhappy, gained a bunch of weight. And at the same time, you know, I was a really sensitive kid and picked up all the anxiety in the house. There was a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of struggle around money and stuff. And I think I was always sort of a light eater. Like what I actually needed was pretty light. Like I remember eating and this is like super important for what happened later, is I ate the meat off the sandwich and threw away the bread, which is really amazing, like for a kid, I think. And but also I developed this love of sugar, of sweets. I would bake cakes. Like this is way back in the day in like the early 60s, mid 60s, cake mixes. And I would make the frosting from scratch, and I'd make like a double batch so I could eat a whole lot of it. So I literally could sort of almost eat sugar out of the box. And
that's funny when you see about the frosting. I'm a frosting person myself. You can have the cake, I'll take the frosting, and I could eat it by the spoonful. Can totally relate to that part of your story. And the dancing part. I used to dance a lot when I was a little girl too, around the living room. Back when we had records, and if you bumped it, it skipped and stuff like that.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Yeah. And was that a happier time for you? Was that before some of the addiction? Yeah, right. Yeah. So then when I was heavy, so like first grade, second grade, you know, I started to get teased. And this is way back in the day of like Twiggy. That wasn't even until I was in junior high. And like a class back in those days, a classroom full of 30, 35 kids, there were usually only two heavy kids. And I was one of them. Now I was a high school teacher, you know, I just gave that up a few years ago, and it's, you know, it's totally different. It's like, I don't know, 40% up to 70% of the kids are really struggling with with food. And weight, you know. And so anyway, and I remember, you know, shopping at Lane Bryant. I loved clothes. I hated Lane Bryant. My mom would sort of put me on display. Like I played piano. I was very musical. And, I hated that whole thing of being objectified, and I was teased. Like when I got to junior high, I remember this, what do you call it? Nickname that, because I was really academically oriented. I used to hide my A's. I just really loved to learn, always, always. Still do. And they called me Brain Blob. And I mean,
What a
really,
bully name.
that was like the cruelest thing, and so then the usual junk is my mom decided to go to Weight Watchers, and I'm like 14. We go to Weight Watchers, and I think I dropped a bunch of weight. And so now I'm like a teenager, like I'm 15, and looking back, I looked great. I used to sew my own clothes and, read all those teen fashion magazines. And I just interested in the whole thing, but I still felt fat. That's the thing, is all of my, later addiction and stuff was a lot about wanting to be thin,
Yes.
and so then after Weight Watchers, it seems like I learned how to restrict really intensely. So I started like not eating very much. And I don't need very much, so the line is really blurry. And so here's the big thing was, I think I was probably 16, and it was Thanksgiving dinner, and I ate too much like everybody. And when I follow the crowd, I get in trouble. And I felt so awful that I went in the bathroom and threw up. And that was the beginning of the end for me. I went into a restrict, binge, purge cycle. And a lot of that was sugar. I was eating, by that time already, I was eating in secret. I would take the Sara Lee frozen like coffee cake out of the freezer and eat it. And then I would take the family car, which I was allowed to drive, and so I was still a really good driver. And I would go to the store and replace it before my mom figured it out. Except looking back, they weren't paying attention. Well, they were paying attention in the sense that they knew I was really unhappy. I became the IP of the family. We went to therapy at I was 13. That's going back a bit, even before the bulimia started. And so they knew, but they pretended they didn't know the details of like me eating a half a loaf of bread and then replacing it, stuff like that. It was
Right.
Really great. It was just my complete obsession.
So what was the turning point? What was it that drove you into learning about and recovering from all of that? Because that is a lot, especially in those teenage years, which we know, statistically speaking, happens to a lot of teenage girls. So I should say teenager, because it can affect boys as well.
More so all the time, it seems like the boys. Yeah, it's so tragic to me. It's like instead of us fixing the girls, we've now pulled the boys, the cultural obsession with it. So
Well,
let
also
me.
to do with the food. Therein lies the
Oh,
problem. We can fix
totally.
the
Yeah,
food. Yeah.
totally. And I know you and I are both on the same wavelength there of the politics of it and the handshake between the fast food industries that are, well, it's not just fast, highly palatable, overly processed, all that.
That's why Chris Van Tulleken says ultra processed foods, ultra processed people. That's the book I really resonated with me. Yeah, I really like that book. So I
Yeah,
mentioned that.
I've heard you talk about that. That's on my list. I haven't read that one.
Okay. Well, it's a page turner, that's for sure. You'll be very
Oh,
invested.
good.
Yeah. Okay,
Yeah,
so going
great.
back, what did you think?
Well, the part that, I need to fast forward for a second is that my bulimia lasted. So I go off to college. It lasted all through my 20s and all through my 30s, basically, like 20 years. I'm very fortunate that I don't have any like physical ramifications, health issues from that. I've got other things, but that's sort of a different story. But so here I am at UC Berkeley, majoring in music, That took me a couple of years to decide. And it's really like hard. It's like a conservatory and stuff, it would be a lot of work. So it was like having a double life. You know, I would do this really disciplined stuff during the day and I would restrict my food. And then I would binge in the evening and kind of into, you know, and it was usually just like one time, like a lot of food, throw it up, couldn't have any tempting food in the house because I would eat it, right? So there's lots of trips to the store, lots of throwing food away so that I wouldn't eat it, you know? And so they, back in the, and like, I remember admitting what was going on, because you asked the turning point, admitting this, the thing to a friend, a music buddy woman, and she was bulimic also. And we would sit in these practice rooms, like in the dungeon, you know, talking about how awful we felt and how ashamed we were, and we couldn't figure it out. So the turning point was kind of early in the sense that I went to therapy at 19, you know, a therapist of my choice, and she was wonderful. And I saw her on and off, actually, CJ, this is so amazing. We should have written a book together, that therapist and I, all the way into my 60s till like 10 years ago, or less than 10 years ago. I'm turning 70 this year. Everybody might want to know that. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. So, and I feel like the best I've ever felt in my life. It's just completely amazing. So that therapist started with body work because that was her bent. And this is way back, you know, in the, late 70s. And bulimia, they had barely named it. Everybody knew about anorexia. They had barely named it. And it certainly was not in the DSM. It didn't get added to that until like, I think 1980, maybe. Actually, I think it's later than that. I looked that up and then I forgot again. But one thing I want to say about it is that she was not an eating disorder therapist. And looking back, I'm sort of glad, because it took me a lot of, you know, all through my 20s and I think early 30s, it's like, I don't fit. And if they had done bulimia, quote unquote, treatment on me or something, it would have been the, thou shalt eat 3 Oreos today because we don't want to make a bad food, good food list. And I was an addict. And I, you know what? I figured that out on my own from a lot of reading and a lot of stuff. I mean, I wasn't definitive about it because I didn't have all of you guys. You know, it hadn't developed as a thing. It wasn't a thing yet. Food addiction or ultra-processed food addiction. It wasn't not even talked about, let alone thought about with the eating disorder, you know. So that's like a really, and I continue, you know, so the turning point was getting to that therapist. And I stayed in therapy for like, I'm again in therapy now. I've been in therapy like most of my adult life. I think everybody should, because it's so amazing. There's so much growth. And I, you know, I think what kind of saved me is I always heard the inner voice. You know, like when I was a kid and taking notes at a lecture, I'd write my own thoughts in the margin. And I had a way of marking them as not what the teacher said, but it was what I was thinking, you know. So I think I valued, except, as I'm sure you know well, because we've, you know, I've heard you talk about, is that inner voice, that observer, treats us like crap, you know. I mean, says really mean and nasty things. So it's trying to unravel all of that stuff. And so I started that really early in therapy, and I wound up majoring in, well, I went, long, long story, I got a master's in music, but I went back and I have a master's in psychology, because that's how much it drove me to want to know. I just wanted to know. And gradually through all that therapy in my 30s and even into the early 40s, I dropped the bulimia. You know, I gradually got out of it. And I, in the 90s, so like I'm in my 40s somewhere, I found Atkins. Like I tried everything. I tried all kinds of different food combinations and all those things because I knew I was starving myself. So it was like, how can I eat during the day? And Atkins became the ticket. That was before, way before keto. And it was before the medical world vilified Atkins. And I still don't even understand that whole thing. But so it just worked for me, like high protein. And all through this time, right, the diet industry is pushing low fat.
Yes,
right.
Sir.
So I'm one of those people. I mean, I assume I'm kind of near Vera's age. I don't know how old Vera is, but when she tells her story, there's a lot of overlap
right.
with the way. Yeah.
So when you were talking about your mother too, that reminds me of time. My mother was always very shameful of the way she was about 100 pounds overweight too. And I tell my dad, I'm very fortunate. I still have my dad. And I tell my dad, I was like, I wish I'd have known more about this. You know, I could have helped my mom. Of course, I didn't know. You don't know what you don't know until you know that you didn't know it. So, but anyways, yep. I think we're all on our own journey. But yeah, it would have been nice to help her to see herself as the beautiful person that she was. And she gave me so much hope to figure it out. And she was my biggest cheerleader. So I guess in that respect, I'm very fortunate because a lot of people don't have those type of people in their lives. And I really credit my parents into helping me save myself.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah.
And my sister's in recovery. Her podcast, actually, by the time this comes out, hers will have come out right before it. So I interviewed my own sister to do her.
Recovery.
So this is actually the perfect play because we keep using the word recovery. And I know that this is something that you want to talk about. So how do you define recovery? What words do you like to use? How do you like to put vocabulary around that?
Yeah, well, I was so enthusiastic, you know, when I heard you talk about your brother and that he doesn't like the word recovery. But what made me so excited was you replace it with growth mindset, which I think is absolutely brilliant, CJ. And it suits me. So part of the trouble I think I have is the binary nature of addict and recovered person, like there's some line that we cross and, you know, for one thing, like we never go back or, you know, whatever. And it's so, and there are other issues I have too, but, so the growth mindset really fits me because I've always been, you know, I'm naturally really anxious and insecure, you know, from this, whatever my history. And I really like to challenge myself to grow out of that, you know, to move forward, to, you know, so yeah, like that tendency, you know, I'm really analytical and I'm a real schemer, and it's like how to turn that into positives for myself and stop catastrophizing all the time, right? So that's kind of, you know, my journey. And so growth mindset appeals to me in the always moving forward. There's always more to conquer, kind of. Yeah, I don't know if I like that word, but the other thing is about AA and the connection to the way we've dealt with addiction for so long, the shame and the blame, the what did you call it? Well, the moral failing that's implied in being an addict. That's why nobody wants the label, right? And so my mixed feelings about AA, I've struggled with alcohol a little bit too, and I still am, actually. That's still kind of, you know, very small quantities, but it bugs me. The craving bugs me, right? So, and I'm sure we'll talk more about cravings. But so the shame piece, like AA doesn't work for me. And it's not the higher power spirituality part. That's actually beautiful. That doesn't bother me at all. But what bothers me is like the, you know, that they're putting themselves down all the time. They seem so ashamed and kind of unhappy. And it's the word powerlessness. That's what bothers me. And I know that inside all of us as addicts, you know, whatever the substance is or behavior is, I feel like I have some of both. I don't feel powerless. I do feel I have to give up certain things, and then I feel a whole lot better. Like I haven't had sugar in, I don't know, 25 or 30 years now. And you'll probably ask me about this later, but the peace that comes, actually, I've heard you say, if you could bottle that and sell it and convince people that that's how they're going to feel if they give up the sugar and the flour and the junk. Right. And I couldn't agree with you more. It's like, it's just completely amazing.
I'd like to buy it and let them taste it. Just taste this and
see. Yeah, just taste it. Yeah.
Taste and see. So
yeah, it's a great metaphor, right? Because we're all about taste. And yeah, and the thing with me is when I go to an AA meeting, when I leave, there I'm never more craving a drink than when I go to an AA meeting, because all of that stuff just makes me feel awful. So, but I don't want to take in, this is not a blanket criticism of AA and all of its offshoots or anything. It's just that part just doesn't work for me. So,
well, you know, and one of the things that we talk about in Sweet Sobriety is you recover, different things will work for different people. And so this is about Linda's journey. And also, we're talking to me, so it's about CJ and Linda's journey. And even though we have overlap, there are certain things that we, I bet, would be across the board, we don't eat. But there would be certain things that we would be, it's very bio-individual, you know. And
yes.
For example, you talk about keto, and you talked about Atkins. And so Atkins diet, people think that the keto was just like this some new diet, but
you're,
it came
right.
from Atkins world. And Atkins came because they needed help with children who had epilepsy to keep them from having seizures. And that's how that diet came up. So when people say, well, the keto diet is a fad diet, I'm like, that diet's not going anywhere. And it does work for some people. It didn't work for me, but it may very well work for someone else. And so, and kind of the same thing that we're talking about here. Different things work for different people. So we're just here to share what does work for Linda, and we can keep it that. The 12-step world, I find a lot of people have recovery in there as well. But something that you hit on was, I think as women, especially now, I will say that probably the biggest portion of our listeners are women, is that as women, we carry a lot of shame. And so I don't necessarily think that the focus being all on, you know, what we have done wrong is such a great idea for women, because we already have that running diatribe in our head of what we've done wrong. We're ever present with it. So I like to look at it as, what are we doing right? And let's build on that.
So I love that.
And that sounds like what you were doing too. You know, you were talking about it. What am I doing right? What is working? How can I improve upon that in that growth mindset that you were talking about? So that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that makes me think of, experimentation. Like, so for example, I went vegan, you know, which is the opposite side of the coin from Atkins, of course. I think I stretched it to 2.5 years. I absolutely hated it. I felt terrible. The reason I was doing it was I've had a lot of chronic pain in my life, and that has shaped this journey a lot too, and have seen a million body workers. And I'm sort of a mystery to a lot of different systems, you know, everything from chiropractic to, you know, just a regular PT, all these people. I was in a lot of pain as a child, and what's happening now, I know I'm going to go back and forth, but I found a body worker about 8 years ago who just is very gifted and is amazing. And he's gifted around figuring out my body. Somehow it just really works. So my feet, like I've had feet trouble my whole life. Like I love to dance and I love to walk, and I couldn't, like as a kid, I couldn't walk on smooth rocks, you know, over anyway, I don't need to tell you all the details, but chronic pain has led me, like, I thought there was something really wrong with me. I thought maybe everybody had the pain. Then I realized when they didn't, like, it just added to, I'm defective, which is how I felt through my childhood. I'm defective. And I think what you bring out about women is a big part of it, because the protagonist in all of our stories, you know, is the boy and the man. And, you know, I'm just divergent a little bit in my thinking and in my body and all these things. So anyway, so I tried the vegan thing because I was told it was great for pain, that it would, because of inflammation. And I just totally doesn't work for me. I remember eating like tons of hummus and I just couldn't get full. I couldn't get energized from it. And so, but I'm going to keep going, you know, la, la, la. So anyway, so that, I think that spirit has sort of really helped me. That's what you were just referring to of being, you know, growth mindset and just trying to navigate our way through a very male dominated world.
And you're willing to try something different and see if it works for you. And that, that is amazing because that, if you'll just keep trying, eventually you will land on something that is working for you. And that's what I think our listeners are trying to figure out. We will, you know, a lot of people want to come in, they want you to give you a diet plan. Well, I can give you a diet plan. I'm using air quotes. People can't see me. I don't mean a diet. I mean how you're going to eat. Because the last thing I want to do when working with clients is put them on a diet. Everybody who comes in here has dieted before. Everybody who starts this journey, most likely, not everybody, I should say a lot of people have dieted and they know how to do that well. But what we want to do is figure out what works for you. And so just that experimenting that you were doing is helping you learn, okay, well, that vegan, I'm not supposed to be vegan. Clearly it's not working for me, but the keto, well, a keto type diet, what did work for you? It's funny. I can almost eat almost vegan. I can get pretty close to vegan and I feel great, but I can't do keto because it doesn't work for me. So here we are, but we're both in on this journey trying to figure out what works for our bodies. So that's amazing.
You know, when I first met you, CJ, I don't know if you remember me at all, but you were so talkative and great in the Saturday morning support group. You were carnivore.
I always think
of you. Yeah. And it seemed like you were really happy about it. So I'm surprised to hear.
I was. I tried it and it seemed like it was working okay. But what I realized after I did some genetic testing and then I tried vegetables and especially in the mornings, I tried more vegetables in the morning. I actually, even though you could put me on any diet and I have a lot of energy. I'm just one of those people that's just very energetic. But what I realized was that I don't really even have like food thoughts at all. Like I eat my breakfast and then I'm off to the races and I don't even think about it until my stomach starts growling again, or it's about the same time every day. And I didn't realize that that was what I was still doing when I was carnivore. But the fiber really agrees with me and it gives me a lot more energy and I can go and do all the things that I'm running around doing in the mornings and it just doesn't faze me at all. But like you said, I was willing to try it to see if it would work for me. And I don't have anything against the carnivore diet. I know it works for some people. It just wasn't working as well as something else.
Yeah. Well, and the other piece of this, I'm sure we agree on, is that different diets at different points in your life. Like, you know, a lot of my friends are, you know, in perimenopause and, you know, getting into the menopause. And it's like, I'm always cheerleading about when you get through that period of the hormones being sort of irregular or imbalanced and you get through all the symptoms, whether you do the hormone replacement or not. It is so great on the other side. Talk about hope, you know, in this podcast, like I've never been more energetic and I'm about to turn 70. It's like totally mind-boggling. It's maybe like when we were 10 years old before all the hormones started or something, you know, so I'm very enthusiastic about that. So maybe our diets change too. I mean,
maybe,
it's about the self-trust, right? To eat what you need to eat. And
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's always kind of like a work in progress with me. Like if I find something that's not working or I see something that might work better, I am the first one. I'm like, let's try it. See what happens. I do that with support. I have my own coach that I talk to about different things. And so with support, and you talked about you having a therapist. And so I think it's helpful to have that support system around you while you're trying to experiment. And I will also say, when I was in early recovery, I didn't trust myself then. So it was nice to have another voice in the room. But now that I've been in recovery for a while, I can say, this is what I'm going to do. And the person that I'm talking to goes, okay, well, let's try it and see what happens. And they're just there to kind of give support to me, but not to give me their opinion of what necessarily. They're just there to help support me. And I think that that is one of the reasons why community is so important when you're on this journey.
Yeah.
To find those people. Okay. Now you've touched on this a little bit, but what coping mechanisms or strategies have you found effective for maintaining your abstinence? Because you've had a long, I think you're the longest, other than Vera, maybe on the podcast that I've had, long-term guests. So I'm sure you have lots of strategies and things that you can impart wisdom on our guests. I mean, on our listeners. Thank you. Forgot the word.
No worries. One thing that came to mind when I was thinking about this before the interview was what I did during the bulimia and stuff is I was a swimmer. And also because of all the chronic pain, it was like the one thing I could do. So that's like, find whatever it is. And for me, it was swimming for years and years and years until my feet got fixed. And now part of what I do is I walk. I live near a beautiful lake and I'm walking that lake almost every single morning. And I mean, if you had told me 20 years ago that I would be a walker, I would just flipped. The other, thing that's just been with me forever is, doing therapy, having coaches now as well. And I'm a big journaler. So every morning with my coffee, and these days, the journaling, I mean, it's so deep and it's so rich. And now it starts to turn into these creative things and like blog posts, because I'm kind of out there doing a thing. And so it's, I know people have trouble with journaling, but I don't know, it's always been my rock.
I'm one of those people.
Yeah.
I have a problem with journaling. I think, when it comes in life, there are people who really enjoy sitting down with their thoughts. And I'm like, my thoughts are the ones like, what's coming next? What are we doing now? Where are we going? What are we doing? And so I do journal. I especially journal when I'm wrestling with big feelings and trying to figure those out. So I will drag my feelings wheel out and try to get to the root of where the problem actually is. So I will. And that has been a big growth for me with Clarissa and Molly, because they're the ones that have encouraged me to do that. And so that made a really big difference. I do that with my clients as well. So I love the feelings wheel now. I can't believe I would say, you would have told me that 2 years ago, I would have called you a liar.
Yeah. Oh, that's so great. Yeah. Because there's something about the pen and the paper that it's, that observer and that, and then also the nasty voice, right? It just becomes very clear on paper. I don't even reread anything almost ever. It's the process of getting all that down. And so it's great for working out problems and also for creating, realizing that you have these very complex thoughts. And then, I just love it. What were you going to say?
That's awesome. Well, maybe I should not reread it, because I do go back and read when I do journal. I'm like, oh, that's interesting, or find out. But I've been known to be halfway through with a journal and then, get sidetracked or whatever, life happens or whatever the case may be. And then I'll go back and I'll find something that I've been journaling in and I just toss it in the garbage, which I think has been very freeing, because I'm like, okay, I'm not rereading all of that, whatever was there. And I'll just toss it in the garbage with probably 40 pages of clean that could be used again. And I'm like, no, just not doing it. It's not worth it. Yeah.
I toss mine. I mean, I've had years and years and years of it. And it's like, it's okay. What I needed to learn is inside me, And so, I toss it.
That's awesome. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to go back to your question, but I'm not sure you want me to talk about food right at this point, as far as strategies.
No, go right ahead.
So, well, I just want to say, because, we can't say it enough, this is sort of how I feel, is I don't eat sugar And I almost never eat flour. Pasta in particular is just awful for me. But I don't have any cravings for it. None. And I mean, it's been 20 plus years, like at least 25 years. And it's so freeing. And it's like, it's okay to experiment and see what happens. So like now, if my, I got to dinner with my husband and he orders dessert, I can have a bite or two. It's like it doesn't do much for me. And it definitely does not lead to cravings or a binge or anything like that. So it's possible. It's totally an addictive substance. It's not food. It's something, but I also want to know that people are on a spectrum about how much, whether they can moderate or not. And that's where we have to be really brutally honest. And if we are, then I just think there's a ton of freedom. So
Right.
that's what,
And
just stay away from it,
also, we're also talking about 25 years, 30 years of abstinence and learning and growing and trying to figure it out what works for you. But I'm sure that when you first started on this journey, or maybe I'm
Oh,
not,
yeah.
no, it's a question, when you first started on this journey, the likelihood of you being able to eat two bites of dessert and then not start eating all the other things that you were trying to get out of your diet. Do you think that would have worked back then?
Not at all. Not at all. And I think it's tricky because now, you'll probably ask me later maybe what I'm struggling with now, but I'll just say it because it's so related to this is I do like to drink wine. But the thing, and I'm still experimenting. I know that moderation, it's just like sugar. I mean, it acts like sugar in our bodies. We know this. But and it's like the fallacy of moderation with alcohol for sure is that you build a tolerance. And in a way, maybe sugars, you could call it tolerance also. Let's see, I'm getting lost. But like, can I drink one drink occasionally and not be craving it at exactly the same hour the next day? That's the issue. And I guess I'm stubborn and I'm still experimenting with it. Do I have to give it up, 100%? So that's where I mean, that's the kind of the truth of where I am, but it's really, really difficult. And it doesn't work for most people, moderating something that addictive. So,
Well, I actually took care of the alcohol before I even addressed the food because
oh.
for me, they were going together. It was the sugar and the wine. And I was using it. And now looking back, I know exactly what I was doing. Now looking back at it, I was using it as a coping skill. I was very much, I was very sad. My mother had recently passed and I was injured. I couldn't exercise. And
Oh, yeah.
I was helping support a family member that needed a lot of support. I had at that time I had my own four children, but plus I had taken custody of another child, and
Oh,
I had
wow.
four dogs, and I was running a business, and it was utter chaos. And I was just kept telling myself, next year I can have my mental breakdown. And I actually was serious about it. I would say that in my head. Next year, you can have, when things are more normal, you can have your breakdown next year. And I used it as the coping mechanism. At the end of the day, when I had given everything to everybody and there was nothing left for anyone else, I would sit down with my wine and my chocolate, and I just wanted to be left alone so that I could just decompress. And it worked until it didn't. And then I had to deal with the aftermath of that. But I don't have any shame or guilt around my coping skills. It got me through that time, and it got the people that I needed to support. It got them through that time, and it's just part of my life that that's there. And now I can move on. I can learn and I can grow from it.
That's awesome, CJ. I love that because we do what we need to do. There's always a good reason. And yeah, there's no need to carry shame. I love that. It was There was one more thing I wanted to say about coping mechanisms, just that's really simple, which is I do prep my food over the weekend
That's
because
awesome. Love that.
I love to eat a ton of vegetables. I do eat pretty differently than my husband. Like I'm a super early riser. He's a very late riser and is up until 3 in the morning and stuff. I'm practically up at 3 in the morning, you know, for the next day. And so we're way off. And finally, after struggling over what's the dinner hour for like years, it's like, wait a second, especially during the week, let's just let all that go. And so now I eat these big salads and, you know, partly cooked vegetables and partly raw, you know, so I do all that on the weekend and it's all done. And I love my food. I just, you know, it's simple and wonderful, really high quality from the farmer's market and, you know, cook my proteins and throw it all together and it's ready. So that's huge for me because it just settles me down. I know it's ready when I want it. So
yeah, we've talked about it on the podcast before where I call my refrigerator plug and play. There's all kinds of foods in there that I can plug together and make what I want. Mm-hmm. And you know, the funny thing is I've noticed this is about myself too. If there's something I really want, there's this particular salad that I'm kind of in love with right now. And it takes some effort to make that salad. It has got a ton of ingredients and a ton of fresh vegetables, all raw. And, but I have to chop them all up because it's got things like broccolini. I don't know if that's it actually.
Yeah. Broccolini. Yeah.
Broccolini and cauliflower. And it's got all carrots and cucumbers and red onions and scallions and different herbs and stuff like that in it. And I love that salad so much that I'm willing to put in all that effort to make it. And it doesn't seem like that much effort because I enjoy making that salad. So I completely get that.
Yeah. And I listen to podcasts. I'm totally in my own world. It's kind of therapeutic to do all the chopping. I can totally relate to what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah.
You did the perfect segue into my question about were there books or podcasts that you helped you in your journey or that you like listening to?
There are so many. I have this list in front of me and it's really, really long, but I think I want to say some of it. And some of it overlaps with what Vera said when you asked her, you know, because we are from the same era. I hope to meet her someday or talk to her. So long ago, what I remember was Jeanine Roth. All those books by Jeanine Roth that are really, really deep about the suffering of, you know, being a woman and relationships and food and really crazy compulsive food behaviors and trying to get out of them. I mean, just she talked about the suffering like so beautifully, so painfully, you know. Then The Highly Sensitive Person by Elaine Aron, which is also old. That whole thing was new. That concept of HSP was new. And I totally resonated with that. And it helped me a lot. I mean, I'm an introvert. And, you know, later I taught high school for like 20 years. I taught high school English and I found my extroverted side, which is very cool, but I'm still basically very much an introvert. So that helped me feel less weird, you know. In the 90s, I think around the time I might have been finding Atkins, I found The End of Overeating by David Kessler. That's the one Vera mentioned. She even corresponded with him because it was about the politics of highly refined food and about personal strategies that I hadn't heard before, even though I was a psych major at, you know, master's level clinical psych. He talked about this one psychologist who was recommending, don't dwell in the middle between yes and no. Go all the way over to the no immediately. Don't, what's the word, negotiate. And no one had said that to me before. In other words, nobody had said, Linda, you're an addict. And it's got to be a hard no. And that's what's going to give you freedom, right? So I experimented with that. I still didn't really get it and wouldn't have used the word addict then probably. And he certainly didn't. Right. But he was recognizing that the foods are made highly palatable is what he called them. And they're being engineered for us to not be able to eat just one, like the ad for, you know. And so I was also even influenced by, you know, because I was really into psychodynamic psychotherapy, like very psychoanalytically oriented. So even Freud had a case of an eating disorder. I was totally into that and knew that Freud didn't quite get it right. But I was trying to figure out what I would have done. And then the little Atkins handbook, like I didn't even read Atkins, really, his theory. I just went for the diet. And then much more recent, of course, is Food Junkies, of course, and a book called The Brain That Changes Itself by Doige about neuroplasticity, because this stuff is new. So we have so much more brain science than when I was struggling with this in the 80s and 90s. Oh my God, CJ, there's so, it's just like what I intuited then and many other people, not just me, has now has hard science to back it up. So I'm kind of, I just, this is an aside from reading the book list, but I'm obsessed with, what do you call it? Insulin resistance. I believe we are all about 3 inches away from being pre-diabetic. If we eat the standard diet in America, we are just screwed. And so that's what I'm about. I have clients and I don't push low carb on people, but that's really where my heart is. So like a podcast that I'm into is called Low Carb MD. Do you know that one?
I haven't listened to that one. No, I don't think I have.
And you know what? There are personal stories that are shared on that. And so I think you'd really like it. But also there's, it's two doctors, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast. And they've exited the major, the medical system. They're practicing on their own and they're really committed to helping their patients get off carbs. And they're reversing diabetes. Like, I really believe that we can reverse diabetes with diet. And so I'm pretty passionate about it. And you know, but the medical world as a whole has not pivoted. And I think it's going to take, I know you like, so on my list is Metabolical by the incredible Robert Lustig, who lives in my area and recently retired from UCSF. I think he's absolutely brilliant. He puts all the pieces together about the politics and the diabetes and, you know, the junky food and all of it and insulin resistance and how we're hoodwinked by the whole thing and how the medical world isn't pivoting and needs to. And he gives us hope by saying seatbelts and smoking. We turned them around. And it, you know, he says, like, a lot of doctors have to die, or a lot of, you know, my generation has to die before this is going to change. So I'm really hopeful that from the bottom up, like all the people you and I hang out with, you know, who are going in this direction, you know, the, and that we can influence the teenagers to maybe eat some real food and grow some real food maybe or whatever. You know, that's where my hope is that we're going to figure out that we are not meant to eat sugar and flour and that it's killing us. And, you know, so and you can kind of guess all the, a lot of the books. Brain Over Binge. I'm curious about, you know, what people are saying about bulimia. I don't quite follow her, but Dopamine Nation by Anna Lemke.
Yeah,
at Stanford.
I studied under her. Yeah, she's awesome.
That's awesome.
She was my professor online, Stanford Medicine Online. She was my professor.
That's awesome. Fantastic. Yeah, yeah, I bet. Wow.
Yeah,
psychiatry, like you said about curing epilepsy, it not only goes back, like, I don't know, you didn't put a date on it, but that actually goes back to the 1940s. Mm-hmm. They were using keto, right? For,
So what, from the stuff that Dr. Lustig talks about and some of the other things that maybe, I can't remember whether it was Lustig or whether it was in ultra-processed people, it was around the 1920s when everything started going real sideways. So oftentimes when people ask me, well, what do I eat? I said, well, here's the rule of thumb. If they made it 120 years ago, it's probably safe. Anything after that is definitely suspect. So that's kind of the rule of thumb that I use.
That's great.
That's quite a list. Yes, I'll have to check out the low carb MD. So I'm curious because I want to talk about what a day in the life looks like. So are there, do you have activities or hobbies that you really enjoy doing now? Or, you know, now that you've been in recovery for a long time, what is a day like look in your life? What kind of things do you enjoy doing?
Well, yeah, I mean, it sort of depends which period of those 25 years, you know, I mean, I'll talk about today, but, I want to say something about relationships, because when I was in the throes of that bulimia, you know, I was sort of, you know, dating the wrong people. I really didn't know what I wanted. I mean, maybe that's, partly my upbringing. It's hard to, tease out all the threads, but I was just so lost. I was really, really lost. And when I finally got out of that bulimia in my 40s, then I was able to, back then we had, we didn't have personal stuff on the relationship apps, right? Dating apps. We didn't have all that yet. But we had like newspaper ads where people were looking for each other. So I actually started doing that. And I started going on dates and really asking myself, what am I looking for? And who am I looking for? And so I wound up getting married at 45. And so I just wanted to say that because my personal life was just the pits as far as relationships. And I had, women friends, but I don't know. I mean, that is a lonely, lonely place when you are addicted, and it can just affect your whole life. So that's the first thing. So like a day in the life now, I love to exercise, and I've always managed to exercise even with all this pain. I was a runner for a while. And now it's aerobics, Pilates type classes, if I can squeeze them in a couple of times a week. And then now I'm walking this 3-mile loop every day. That's how my morning, after my coffee and journaling, I go walk the lake. I do a set of stairs that's near the lake, which is like something like a 5-story building or something, go up it and down. And, on a normal day, I'll do 5 reps, and on, then I'll challenge myself to do 10. Not bad for 70 years old, so it's just really, really fun. And I'm an entrepreneur. So I retired from teaching around COVID time. I taught from home a little bit. Not because of COVID, but I needed a wrist surgery. And so it was like, it was time, So back then I was a teacher all day and also very high energy. So I retired in 2020 June, and then I sort of messed around and was depressed like everybody with COVID, and had been researching coaching for many, many years, and had a coach myself in around 2017, couldn't find my niche, and then finally I kind of put it together, because when I was in the throes of the bulimia, I used to say, if I ever figure this out, I really want to help other people. And what I said then was, I really want to help teenagers. That's sort of hard to do, but at least I can help some adults. So I'm having a blast. And that's kind of my day. And, I watch Netflix like everybody. It's kind of like what you said about, I was touched by the wine and the chocolate. It's like, we kind of do what we need to do. Everybody needs that. So some people meditate, and I've never really done a meditation practice. But I have other things that are like really calming. I'll like put my feet up the wall,
I do that.
Do you do that? Yeah. Yeah. Boy, that's very calming. So I have a lot of little strategies, and
I like to try to get out if the weather permits, because our weather can be somewhat, they say in Georgia, and I'm sure they say this in other places too, if you don't like the weather one day, wait a day, it will change. So, So that, I like to get the sun on my face first thing in the morning. The weather's nice, I'm more apt to do that in the spring, summer, and fall than I am in the winter. I can look at it from the window because it's usually too cold here in Atlanta. At least it is for me. All right. I want to talk about your support system. When you were in early recovery and now your support system now, can you tell me how the role of friends and family helped you in your journey, or coaches, or therapists, or all the people? You touched on it a little bit here and there.
Yeah. I might be a little bit outside the norm on this, because I am such an introvert, and because I've been talking to myself through journaling, I guess, a lot forever. So it's mostly been through psychotherapy. It really has. And now coaching, like I am part of a community of it's the Life Coach School, which is, I don't even know where the physical location is anymore. It's not like I've done a training with them, but I'm sort of part of their learning community. So I have access to coaches. So that's on top of my therapy. And I've gone in and out of group contexts. I had a really serious issue with a psychotherapy with a, he was my therapist. And it's kind of a long story, but I got involved in a very authoritarian community when I was studying to be a therapist, and it really derailed me. And it was also the most incredible learning experience of my life of getting out. But it took me a long, you know, it was like an 8-year saga. So, and in a way that was the, it sort of overlapped with me giving up the bulimia. It's like I went into another problem and had to act out another problem. And then when I left that, boy, then I was really like an adult and I was in my 40s and I had to recover from that. So I have, I guess, an ambivalence about group settings. They've been, in part as temperament and part is my S detector is very high. And I, so, yeah.
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 So what does the future hold for you? What is it that you're looking forward to?
Well, I'm way into being an entrepreneur. And as somebody who's worked in the public sector my whole life, you know, this is brand new, way harder than I expected. But I'm totally excited. It takes my whole day. Like you said, you eat your breakfast and then you forget about food and you go do your thing. And I'm challenging myself to a very high level right now. So that's what I'm excited about. And all the books and everything that we're talking about and the struggles are, it's all woven in. It's like I'm taking all the skills that I've built over this lifetime. And a lot of it was pretty painfully negotiated, you know, I'm taking all of it and I'm pouring it into this, helping other people who struggle with food.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, we're winding down here. So I'm going to ask you, we have our signature question. And I said, so I'm going to ask you our signature question is, if your body or spirit could speak, what would it say about the changes that you have made on your journey?
So now I'm going to cry. It's sort of imagining that teenager that I was, right? And in my 20s, so lost. So I would give her a hug and tell her, you're not defective. As a matter of fact, the thoughts that you're thinking are brilliant. Follow them. Because I couldn't. So she wouldn't have been able to hear it, most likely. But that's what my spirit would say.
That's awesome. Maybe she wouldn't have heard, but.
Yeah, maybe she, yeah.
We're grateful now.
It's been
a journey. You're still on it and it's amazing. And I really appreciate you being here to tell everybody about your experience, Linda. I appreciate you being our guest today. So thank you so much.
Thank you, CJ. It's been wonderful.
Thank you for joining me this week for Food Junkies Recovery Stories. Make sure you join our Facebook group, Sugar Free for Life Support Group, I'm Sweet Enough. Please subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in today's story, we would appreciate a ratings on iTunes. If you've been inspired by today's show and would like to be a guest, please reach out through the email provided in the show notes. If you have additional questions, CJ is a food addictions professional and works one-on-one with clients. You can find her email address and website in the show notes. Thank you for joining us.